Good afternoon. The time is 12:06 and you're tuned to 89.1 FM WBOY Fort Wayne. This is Health 360 Midday Matters. And if you have a question or a comment, we'd love to hear from you. 260-452-1185. You can always post on our Facebook page, Midday Matters, or send us an email, middaymatters@nipr.fm. I'm Sarah D'Elia, joined in the studio this afternoon with my co-host, Dr. Peter Rothman.
Thank you, Sarah. Today we will be discussing seizure disorders and epilepsy in children and adults with Dr. Atiyah Khan, pediatric and adult neurologist with the Fort Wayne Neurological Center with specialized training in epilepsy at Harvard Medical Center. Welcome, Dr. Khan.
Thank you.
Epilepsy is a chronic condition of the brain that affects 65 million people throughout the world and over 2 million in the United States. 1 in 26 Americans will develop epilepsy at some point in their lifetime, with 150,000 to 200,000 new cases diagnosed in the United States each year. Epilepsy is the fourth most common neurologic disorder in our society after migraine headaches, stroke, and Alzheimer's disease. While epilepsy is one of the world's oldest known medical conditions, too many people don't understand it, and this misconception has led to fear, discrimination, and social stigma in too many cases. The goal of seizure therapy is to prevent seizures and to allow these affected individuals to lead full and active lives. Increasing epilepsy awareness and better epilepsy education are clearly necessary to enhance these goals. And here to enhance our understanding of epilepsy is Dr. Khan. Dr. Khan, what actually is a seizure, and when does a seizure disorder become defined or diagnosed as epilepsy?
We can think of seizures as abnormal electrical discharge of a neuron, neurons in the brain, producing abnormal behaviors. Now, a single seizure does not mean epilepsy. So the definition of epilepsy is if a person has recurrent, unprovoked seizures. Now, most people think of seizures as shaking of the body, what people refer to as grand mal seizures, but that's not the only type of seizure that's out there. That's the one that most people fear, and maybe that's why people have so much stigma or fear of the condition epilepsy and prefer using the term seizure disorder or convulsions. But I want to demystify this. So when I say it's a recurrence, so if a person keeps having seizures after seizures, they may have epilepsy. And then if it's unprovoked, that means there wasn't a cause that caused the seizure. So for example, a diabetic who gives himself too much insulin could have low sugar and then have a hypoglycemic seizure. That means low sugar caused their brain to have a seizure. Or someone who has an electrolyte imbalance, for example, low sodium or low calcium, could have a seizure. Or children, as a response to fever, could have a febrile seizure. So if it's provoked due to a condition in your body, and another one that people should be aware of is recreational drugs like cocaine. Now, if it's not provoked and it happens recurrently, so there's no reason why they're having it, then that could be epilepsy. A person who has a provoked seizure, for example, if they have hypoglycemia, low sugar, could end up having epilepsy if the low sugar was such that it damaged the brain. And then henceforward, they had seizures just because the brain was damaged. So sometimes patients will have a single seizure and will diagnose them as having epilepsy. And why is that? There are certain tests we do to test if you have epilepsy or not, and one of the tests that we do is called EEG or electroencephalogram. Now, if your EEG shows findings that shows that you have brain irritation, then even though you had your first seizure, I can confidently say that that seizure was because you have underlying epileptic disorder or epilepsy. Sometimes people have an EEG and their EEG is normal, and then I still think they have a seizure disorder or epilepsy, and they're upset, and they say, well, my test was normal. Why do you think that I have epilepsy? So I want to talk a little bit about that if I can. When we do electroencephalograms or EEG, we record brain waves as they're happening. What I mean by that, it doesn't reflect what happened 2 days ago or what happened a year ago. I'm recording what's happening right now. So I'm sleepy, I'm going to show sleepiness. If I'm awake, I'm going to show wakefulness. But in that half an hour recording, if I don't show the abnormality, it doesn't mean that I don't have it. And so it's a matter of how long I record or how often my brain shows those abnormal electrical discharges. Some people find it difficult to understand what do you mean by electrical discharges. So an analogy I use for my patients is when I'm doing an EEG, I'm looking for sharp waves or spikes, or we can think of them as sparks. When those sparks become fire, then you have a seizure. Now, chances are that when you come in and have an EEG, I'm not going to be able to catch that fire. You have seizures once in 6 months, or you only had one seizure. I'm looking for those sparks. Seeing those sparks tells me that you have an underlying seizure disorder. If you have the sharps or sparks, doesn't mean that you're having a seizure all the time. So some people say, well, what did you see? I didn't have a seizure when I had the EEG. I was looking for those sparks. Another concept that I want to bring is that medications don't cure you. So the medications may lay down a barrier to not let these sparks become fire. And if a person is going to cure themselves, if they're going to outgrow their seizures, they could, but some people won't. And so we want to make sure that that barrier is good enough that those sparks don't keep becoming fires.
Now, the age differential of seizure disorders in our society, you mentioned there's two peaks.
Yes. So the two peaks are one in early childhood, less than 2 years, and the other peak is after the age of 65 years. And when we think about it, it's intuitive that that would happen. When babies are born, and let's say they have a brain malformation, or during the process of delivery, they didn't get enough oxygen to their brain and they have brain damage, or they have an underlying genetic or metabolic conditions, most of those conditions are going to present early on in life. It may present in the neonatal period, it may present immediately after birth, or it could take a while to show up. Some of the genetic conditions that are highly associated with epilepsy would present early in childhood. The second peak is our elderly population, especially after the age of 65. Again, it's intuitive. Think about it. Who gets strokes? It's the elderly. What are the chances that you have a brain tumor or you have a tumor in your body and it spreads to the brain when we're older? When do we get degenerative conditions like Alzheimer's when we're older? So some people are shocked that it's the elderly who have the highest incidence, but it is. And 10% of patients with Alzheimer's actually have epilepsy.
I want to remind our listeners that this is Health 360 Midday Matters here on WBOY. And if you have a question or comment, 260-452-1185 is the number to call. And you can always post on our Facebook page, Midday Matters, or send us an email at middaymatters@nipr.fm. We have Christine, who's been waiting patiently on the line, who has a question about seizures. Christine, welcome to Health 360.
Thank you for taking my call. I have a 19-year-old niece who was recently diagnosed with seizures. And I haven't done any research, so I thought I'd call and find out. Two parts of my questions. Does stress, whether it be job stress or life stress, is that possibly a triggering mechanism for a seizure? And then my niece gave me some information because I think it's malarkey, but I'd like the doctor to. She mentioned cocaine use. My niece is of the persuasion that cannabis can be used as for medicinal purposes for seizures, and I was curious as to whether or not there was any truth in that. If not, does it have an adverse effect with seizures?
Thanks for your call. So let's start off with the first part of that question, which was stress-related. Is that a trigger for seizures?
So that's a great question. Patients who have epilepsy, I always give them advice as to things they should do to make sure that they don't have seizures. The first thing is that they should take their medications. The second thing is that they should get enough sleep. Sleep deprivation can be a trigger for seizures in patients who are well controlled. And stress can play a role in not being able to get good quality sleep. So certainly, If you have underlying epilepsy, then stress can play a role and bring it out. Now, stress per se causing seizures without having underlying predisposition, not likely. So a person has to have an underlying predisposition. The brain, the neurons have to be firing abnormally. And then if there's a provocation like prolonged sleep deprivation, major stress, yes. Your second question about marijuana. Well, there is a lot of information on recreational drug use causing epilepsy. I have to say there's not that much data on marijuana. Now, if you have underlying seizure disorder and you use these drugs and that makes you lackadaisical, you forget to take your medications, yes. And I do not buy that it relaxes me, and doctor said that stress is bad for me, so I'll just use marijuana so I can relax and not have seizures.
I think it's also been pointed out that caffeine can have an effect, possibly by keeping awake and not allowing you to have appropriate sleep patterns. But I think cocaine and meth addiction have been definitely implied.
Definitely methamphetamines. And triggering. Sometimes when patients come into the emergency room, and if we are suspicious, we will actually do a toxic screen, urine and blood, to make sure it wasn't a toxic cause. And not just recreational drugs. There are certain medications that can lower your seizure threshold or make you more prone to have seizures.
And so what we should take away from the stress-related question is that stress in and of itself doesn't cause seizures, but it may cause you to have poor sleeping patterns, and that could cause the seizure.
Absolutely.
Okay. 260-452-1185 is the number to call. If you have a question or comment, we're talking about seizures and seizure disorders and epilepsy today. You can always post on our Facebook page, Midday Matters, or send us an email, middaymatters@nipr.fm. I'm Sarah D'Elia, joined in the studio today by our guest Dr. Khan, as well as my co-host Dr. Peter Rothman. We need to take a short break here on Health 360, but we'll be back with more in just a few moments.
On Talk of the Nation, we like to be clear about what we're talking about, whether it's movies.
A B-movie was a movie that was made specifically to be on the bottom half of a double feature.
Or the auto industry.
One mid-level executive at a top automaker told me, well, 30 years ago, we were a car company that would occasionally lend money to our customers, and now we're a bank that makes cars.
Talk of the Nation, clear, straight, open, from NPR News. This afternoon at 2 p.m. here on WBOI.
You help pay for public education in Indiana, but from the Capitol to the classroom, the payback isn't always clear. You can find out how the state's policy impacts your family in our new State Impact Indiana Project, a local national collaboration between Indiana public broadcasting stations and NPR. You can hear the stories during Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and Weekend Edition on NIPR, and dig deeper with a click on the State Impact logo at nipr.fm.
Support for this program on WBOI is provided by ATM & Company, a CPA firm providing accounting, audit, tax, and consulting services to businesses and individuals in northeastern Indiana. Details at 490-ATMO.
Support for this program on WBOI is provided by Cameron Memorial Community Hospital, providing health and wellness services in the spirit of charity, concern, and excellence, serving Steuben County and surrounding areas. Information at CameronMCH.com.
Welcome back to Health 360 Midday Matters here on WBOY. The time is 12:21. Question or comment? You can give us a call at 260-452-1185. The phone lines are wide open right now. You can always email us, middaymatters@nipr.fm, or post on our Facebook page. I'm Sarah D'Elia, and we're joined in the studio this afternoon by my co-host, Dr. Peter Rothman, as well as Dr. Khan, who's helping answer all of your questions and explore seizure disorders and epilepsy and what you need to know. 260-452-1185, again, is that number to call.
Dr. Khan, for many years, people would use the old terms grand mal seizures, petit mal seizures, but we now have new classifications of the different types of seizures. So what are the different types, and what diagnostic techniques are used to differentiate these techniques and then choose the appropriate medication to treat them?
So when we think about the different types of seizures, there's one way of thinking about classification or what the manifestations are. If you go back to the brain, and let's say we have EEG or electroencephalogram running, if a person has a seizure and the seizure starts in one part of the brain, then the term we will use is partial or focal epilepsy. If the abnormality shows everywhere at the same time, so in all regions of the brain, then we'll think of it as a generalized epilepsy. So two broad categories, partial or focal, and the other one is generalized. Now, partial can remain partial, or it can stay in one part of the brain. So then we call it just partial. If it doesn't stay in one part of the brain and spreads to the rest of the brain, then we call it partial, secondarily generalized. So this is different from a seizure that started everywhere at the same time. Partial is also thought of as if your consciousness is impaired or not. If it's not impaired, then we call it simple partial. And if it's impaired, then we call it complex partial. Some people think that you have to be unconscious when you have a seizure, not necessarily. So if you're conscious, then we'll call it simple partial. If you have just impairment, if you're confused, if it's night but you think it's morning, that's a complex partial seizure. Now, the manifestations of seizures depends on where your seizure starts. So if it starts in your motor area or the area of the brain that controls muscle, then you may have jerking or stiffening, but you don't necessarily have to have that. If it starts in your visual cortex, then you could just have visual phenomena. You could see things, flashing lights, colored dots. If you have areas of the brain that's called autonomic, you could just feel sick, nauseous, a butterfly sensation, heat rising. There are different types of generalized seizures. And one of the ones you mentioned, perimal, or what we call absence seizures, is very common in childhood. A lot of times it's picked up by teachers when you notice that the child is staring blankly, is absent from consciousness. They may not have any other outward manifestations, or they may have rapid eye blinking, lip smacking. Another type of generalized seizure is called myoclonic seizure. And all of us have experienced myoclonic jerking. You know, when you fall asleep and you have this sensation that you're falling down, that's a myoclonic jerk. But what you and I experience is not a myoclonic seizure, but a person who has seizures of that type is having myoclonic epilepsy. So that's another type of generalized seizure. You can have tonic seizures, and tonic implies that all your muscles are contracted at the same time. Now, you may hear the term epileptic cry. Why does that epileptic cry, this kind of scream that happens before a seizure? That's your tonic phase. So your vocal cord muscles are contracting, your diaphragm is contracting, your intercostals are contracting. These are muscles of the rib cage. And so as your vocal cords are contracting, it's forcing air out of a closed glottis, and you hear that cry. Another type of generalized seizure is a clonic seizure, and that's alternate contraction and relaxation. And that's where you hear the sound that goes like, and that's because you get alternate contraction and relaxation. Yet another type of generalized seizures, atonic seizures, and they can be extremely dangerous because suddenly your body loses tone. So if I'm standing, my whole body loses tone. All of a sudden, I'm going to fall to the ground. My patients who have atonic seizures, unfortunately, have to wear helmets with face guards to protect them because otherwise they're going to end up with skull fractures. They're going to damage their teeth. So particularly atonic, but other types of seizures can become dangerous. So that was one way of thinking of different types of seizures, depending on where it starts in the brain. Now, another way of thinking about seizure classification or different types of seizures is, do we know what the cause is? And we can classify that as, if you don't know the cause, then it's idiopathic, or we don't know what the cause is, or cryptogenic, or the cause is hidden. And surprisingly, that's 70% of the seizures. And then where we do know the cause, we call it symptomatic. So the seizure is a symptom of something else that happened to you. And typically it's remote symptomatic. And what do we mean by that? The insult may have happened in childhood, but you present with seizures now. So two broad categories, idiopathic or cryptogenic, which is about 70%, and symptomatic, which is about 30%. Now, in that idiopathic or cryptogenic category, you have the genetic seizures, and this is where it may be inherited or it runs in families, and it's extremely common. More and more, we're discovering that what we thought was cryptogenic or we didn't know the cause is actually genetic, and it could be a mutation of channels in our cells. For example, potassium channel mutations can produce seizures in babies. Sodium channel mutation produces a very devastating type of seizures called Dravet syndrome. And now, as genetic information is just exploding, sometimes what we thought was idiopathic, we can do a genetic test and give a definitive diagnosis. Just because it's genetic doesn't always carry a bad implication. Some of the genetic epilepsies, for example, benign rolandic epilepsy, has an extremely good outcome. Most patients will outgrow it. It does not affect their intelligence. It usually does not affect education. Your other question was, how do we investigate or what do we do for diagnosis? I had mentioned electroencephalogram or EEG. That's a test where you will come in and they'll put electrodes on the surface of your scalp. So it's not going inside the brain. It's on the surface. Electrical potentials from the brain cells are magnified and they're recorded by surface electrodes. Now, there are different ways of doing EEGs. The routine EEG can run usually 30 minutes to an hour, depending on the age and circumstance. And during an EEG, we will do activation procedures, like we'll flash lights into your eyes, we'll make you hyperventilate, and preferably you've come in sleep deprived so we can capture some sleep also. If we don't find an abnormality or we want to further define the type of seizure you're having, there are other ways of doing EEGs. A test we can do in the hospital is called a video EEG, where you have a video camera that's synchronized to the EEG recording, and microsecond to microsecond, I can look at the patient and figure out what they do, whether it correlates with abnormal electrical activity in the brain. There's also potential to do ambulatory EEG. So you come into my office, we can put EEG electrodes on your head, we can wrap the electrodes, and then on a fanny pack, you carry a small computer, if you want to call it, and you will carry that home, and we can do it for 24 hours, 48 hours, 72 hours. So the ability with these testing, which are prolonged, is sometimes we can capture episodes, and we can define for you whether those episodes of concerns are seizures or not. For example, somebody's passing out, you know, is that a seizure or it's not a seizure? Somebody stares, is that a seizure or not a seizure? Or they have abnormal sensations inside their body, is that a seizure, not a seizure? So usually we'll have either button pushes to indicate the second you felt that, or an onlooker could make a note of the exact time when you were having it. And then when you come back, we can go back to the exact spot and pinpoint for you whether it was a seizure or not. Now, unfortunately, you're not going to have a positive test every time you have EEG. And people do get upset because they want to know, where is my seizure coming from? Which part of my brain is acting up? The statistics are that if you do one EEG, only 60% of EEGs will show the abnormality, even though we know that you're having epilepsy. If you do four routine EEGs, you have a 90% chance of catching abnormality. Some people are never going to show an abnormality because it's in the depth of their brain. And in my previous job, part of my job was doing epilepsy surgery, where we would take out parts of the brain that were abnormal and essentially cure people of epilepsy. For that, you have to sometimes have to do tests where you drill holes in the skull and put depth electrodes. So electrodes go inside parts of the brain to see if there is abnormal activity in those parts. Or you take off the skull and put electrodes on the surface of the brain, try and capture which part of the brain is causing the abnormal discharge.
I want to remind our listeners that you're listening to Health 360 Midday Matters here on WBOY. And if you have a question or a comment, our phone lines are wide open. You can give us a call at 260-452-1185. You can always post on our Facebook page, Midday Matters, or send us an email at middaymatters@nipr.fm. We're spending the whole show today talking about seizures, seizure disorders, and epilepsy. And we have Dr. Khan, who is in the studio today, helping to answer your questions. I'm Sarah D'Elia, and my co-host, Dr. Peter Rothman, is, of course, on board today. I wanted to kind of switch our conversation into what do folks need to know if they see somebody that is having a seizure? And if you're somebody that's newly diagnosed with epilepsy, or you know that you're prone to seizures, what do you need to know yourself if you feel these signs and symptoms coming on? Or what should you tell folks if you see, you know, if they see a blank stare or some of those symptoms that we talked about earlier?
I think this is very important. So there are a lot of misconceptions around this, and it would be very useful if everyone knew first aid for seizures. So let's talk about first aid for seizure for a generalized seizure or grand mal seizure. This is where a person may or may not have any warning, and they may go into a seizure where they would have a stiffening of the body and then jerking of the body. You know, for patients, it's very embarrassing at times because they have incontinence. And what do I mean by that? That they could lose urine or lose stools. Why does that happen? When your muscles contract, if your bladder is full, it pushes on that full bladder and you have urinary incontinence. So for socially, you know, if you're in a restaurant, you have that. It's very awkward for a kid to be in school. It's very awkward. But that's just part of the seizure. What else can happen? A person can bite their tongue. If the tongue is in the way and your face muscles are contracting, then it's not uncommon to have pretty severe tongue bites. People think they can swallow their tongue, and I reassure them, no, you cannot swallow the tongue. The tongue is attached to the roof of the mouth. What can happen, however, is if you have a seizure and you're lying on your back, your tongue can fall back and block your airway. Or something else that can happen is that you can have excessive salivation or drooling or frothing, or you can throw up or vomit during a seizure. And if you're lying on your back, it can go into your lungs. So in terms of first aid, what should you do? If a person is in an unsafe situation, you know, they're inside a bathtub, they're in a swimming pool, they're somewhere where they could get hurt, get them to a safe place immediately. Turn them to the side. It doesn't matter, right side, left side, it doesn't matter. So the tongue will fall to the side. It won't occlude the airway. If they're going to throw up, hopefully it'll come out from the side of their mouth. There is no need to hold on to the tongue, and that's a common misconception. There is no need to put something in the mouth to push the tongue down. If they are having active contraction, when you try and force something in their mouth, you may end up damaging their teeth or damaging their mouth. And if you try to hold on to a tongue, then they might end up biting your finger. So this is an absolute misconception that you should force something in the mouth. People ask me, well, if I'm eating or my child is eating and, you know, they have a seizure, isn't there a big risk that they could aspirate? There is a risk. But it would be a bigger risk if you pushed your finger in to try and remove that food. You'd probably push it down their lungs. So my suggestion is if their mouth is slack, it's open, you can quickly reach in and push it out, that's fine. But if they're in the tonic phase where they're contracted, don't bother, just turn them to the side. As far as safety, think about it. If you have a seizure sitting down or if you have a seizure standing up, you'll fall to the ground. You could get hurt. But if you're in water, you'll drown and you will die. And unfortunately, every year there are patients with epilepsy who die because of drowning. So one advice is don't sit in bathtubs of water. Don't sit in swimming pools. Anywhere where if you had a seizure, you would be unsafe. And if you were alone, then you could die. We have heard of patients who die taking a shower because when they fell, they occluded the drain and water accumulated. And unfortunately, they fell face down and their nose was down and they basically drowned in a bathtub. So recommendation is take a shower. If you're swimming, you just tell someone, I have a seizure, and don't goof off. Don't pretend you're dead or drowning, because you do that plenty of time. The one time you have a seizure, people think you're still goofing off. For mothers and for fathers, for parents, what I tell them is please don't leave your baby in a bathtub of water or in a swimming pool. None of us mean to, but the phone rings and you go away. And when you come back, the baby has had a seizure and is lying face down. If you are a patient who has epilepsy and you have a warning and you can talk, because some people, their speech area is affected, they cannot talk, indicate that you think you're going to have a seizure. If you're alone, lie down. Because chances are then you won't fall down and you would be protected. Again, this goes back to the whole stigma of having epilepsy or seizures. You know, people share very casually, oh, I have high blood pressure, my cholesterol is high. There is so much shame associated with having epilepsy, people hide it. And I can understand, because society does not understand this. I mean, even this day, just before I came for this program, this was an issue I was dealing with. I have a patient who, God bless her, has tried so hard. She's gone to school, gone to college, got a degree, got a job, got married. But it's tough. Seizures don't happen predictably. It's not that the first of every month she knows she's going to have a seizure and she can lie down. When they happen unpredictably, when it happens at work, immediately there's stigma attached. And then it's difficult for her. Because, number one, she cannot drive. So can she get to work? Does she have to depend on a family member? And people think, well, you know, why can't you work? Because you don't have seizures all the time. You only have it unpredictably. But think about it. If I'm a surgeon and if I have a seizure, unfortunately, while I'm doing surgery, that wouldn't have a good outcome.
Right.
I think it's been said that when one is witnessing a seizure and a family member or friend, stay calm and protect the patient, clear the area around so they can't harm themselves, and realize you can't stop the seizure. Don't try to hold them or let it be. It will usually end on its own, and then be reassuring and comforting to the patient right afterwards. Now, yes?
Absolutely. But I do want to mention that sometimes seizures don't stop, and that's called status epilepticus.
Right.
And one should know that if it doesn't stop, one should call the ambulance.
How long does a typical seizure last, and when is too long that you need to call the ambulance?
So there is no time duration, that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But my usual recommendation is if a seizure hasn't stopped in 5 minutes, go ahead and call the EMS. And the reason is a brief seizure likely will not cause brain damage, but if one goes on and on having seizures, seizures per se can cause brain damage. So 5 minutes is long enough. If it hasn't stopped, call EMS. If they come, seizure stop, that's fine. If not, then the patient needs certain medications to stop it.
Now, part of the diagnostic techniques include a history and physical to rule out underlying medical conditions like brain infections or multiple sclerosis or lupus. So we've done the medical workup, we've taken a good history, we ask obviously the families of these patients to time the seizures, describe exactly what they saw, which would help the neurologist make the diagnosis. You've made your diagnosis, and now we're ready for treatment. What are the approaches?
So one thing I should mention, part of the diagnosis is EEG, but the other part is neuroimaging, or taking a picture of the brain to figure out what's going on. And in neuroimaging, there are different techniques available. You have heard of CAT scans and you've heard of MRI. And MRI is much preferable. It gives much more details. Sometimes a CAT scan is adequate. You have a big tumor, you can probably see it on the CAT scan. But sometimes a CAT scan is negative, and then we insist that a patient gets an MRI because that will give us finer details. So treatment really depends on what's causing it. And there are really two ways of thinking about it. If you have a brain tumor, well, obviously the brain tumor needs treatment, but in the meantime, I need to control your seizures. If the cause is clear, it's low sugar, I need to give you glucose, because giving you seizure medication when your blood sugar is causing the seizure will not be very helpful. So if you have a cause for the seizure, then you treat the cause. When it's epileptic seizure, then medications is usually the first line. And a question that I get asked is, does everyone who's had a seizure need seizure medications? And the answer is no. There are exceptions. But usually the answer is, with first seizure, we may not necessarily put you on seizure medications. If we do decide to treat, then there are over 20 seizure medications, and it depends on the type of seizure you experience or the type of epileptic syndrome would determine what medication we choose.
We have a caller on the line. Olivia, welcome to Health 360 Midday Matters.
Dr. Khan?
Yes?
I have a question regarding seizures in animals. Is it possible for dogs to be able to sense when their master is about to have a seizure?
Yes. So, good question. And when I first learned about it, I was shocked. I was very skeptical. But yes, there are seizure dogs, and some of my patients have them. And these are very sophisticated animals. So they can sense, even before the patient knows that they're having a seizure, that their master is going to have a seizure, and they are trained. The epilepsy dog is trained. They go through a rigorous training program. So they can push a person to sit down or try and make them safe. I have heard, now I've not seen a dog do this, but I've heard they can even call 911, but must be a special phone. But yes, that's very true. There are seizure dogs. Very expensive. They're out there.
If you have a question or comment, 260-452-1185 is the number to call. Or you can post on our Facebook page, Midday Matters, or email us, middaymatters@nipr.fm. We need to take a quick break for the news, but we'll be back with more of Health 360 in just a few moments.
Collaboration, innovation, and engineering serendipity in Silicon Valley.
People walk down between the chairs, they bump into each other. It's actually called a Google bump. And you go, hey, and then you sit down and talk.
Designing workplaces meant to keep employees happy, creative, and in the office. Later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 here on WBOI.
Good afternoon, I'm Sean Beter with WBOI News. Several Indiana mayors are planning to tell state legislators about the problems their cities face from methamphetamine production while they seek tougher controls on the cold medications often used to make it. Lawmakers are considering a proposal to tighten existing limits on pseudoephedrine purchases, but mayors and some police groups say even tougher steps are needed as communities face explosions and toxic chemical cleanups tied to producing the illegal drug. Some local officials want a law requiring a doctor's prescription to buy pseudoephedrine-based products. Mayors from Evansville, Muncie, Warsaw, and Plymouth are expected to attend an Indiana House Committee hearing on the issue today. Lawmakers over the past few years have declined to require prescriptions for the cold medicines, saying it would make them more expensive for law-abiding people. State lawmakers want to help parents find out whether their child's school is family-friendly. As Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports, legislation unanimously approved by a House committee Tuesday aims to increase parental involvement in education.
Legislation authored by Gary Democratic Senator Earlene Rogers would direct the Department of Education to develop the Family-Friendly School designation. It would allow schools to apply to the state agency for the title that signals a strong level of family and parental involvement in student education. The Department of Education would develop the exact guidelines for what makes a school family-friendly. Rogers says that could include teachers who help parents understand the best ways to help their children with homework.
A lot of times parents just say, you know, turn off the TV and read. But there would be an effort there to teach parents in terms of how the teacher is teaching reading.
John Barnes is the Legislative Affairs Director for the Department of Education. He says the goal of the family-friendly school designation pairs well with some of Superintendent Glenda Ritz's efforts.
She's concerned about advancing a literacy initiative, which would also be focused not just on children reading, but families reading and creating a climate and an attitude and an atmosphere where literacy is so important.
Rogers says she hopes that as schools begin receiving the family-friendly designation, it will encourage other schools to develop programs that will earn them the label. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith.
And a Northern Indiana land trust has added another 130 acres to its holdings, including land boasting 30-foot bluffs overlooking the Maumee River. Acres Land Trust says it recently finished acquiring 87 acres at Blue Cast Springs in Allen County and 43 acres at the Richard Brunner Nature Preserve on Pigeon Pond in Steuben County. The purchases boost the nonprofit conservation group's land holdings to more than 5,000 acres at 85 nature preserves around Indiana. Huntington-based Acres says the Blue Cast Springs site features upland forest land, ravines, and 30-foot bluffs overlooking about 3,000 feet of Maumee River frontage. Right now in the WBOY weather forecast, expecting snow showers up until about 2 p.m. today, cloudy skies with a high near 32, overnight a 10% chance of snow, a low around 22, and some sunshine on Thursday, a high near 39 degrees. You're listening to Midday Matters Health 360 on WBOI.
Welcome back to Health 360 Midday Matters here on WBOY. The time is 12:47. If you have a question or comment, we just have about 12 minutes left in today's program. You can write in middaymatters@nipr.fm or post on our Facebook page, middaymatters, or send us you can pick up the phone and call us, 260-452-1185. We're going to head to the phone lines right now. We have a question about blackouts and how they pertain to seizures. Ken, welcome to Health 360.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm experiencing blackouts. I don't know what else to call them. The neurologist is having a difficulty diagnosing exactly what it is. They've happened randomly. First time was about a year ago. I was out for nearly 3 hours. The second time was a shorter period, about 15 minutes. It just happened the other day. I was out again about 2 hours. Sometimes I have somewhat of a warning. My gait is erratic. I can't walk straight. That happened just the other day and lasted for nearly 6 hours. I did not go out.
So, you know, that's a good point because every blackout is not a seizure. And you said your neurologist was having a difficult time diagnosing it. And sometimes that can happen. So what did I mean by not every blackout is a seizure? I'm assuming by blackout it's a loss of consciousness. And faints can cause loss of consciousness. And the term we'll use for that is syncope. This can happen because your blood pressure falls suddenly or because you have a cardiac arrhythmia, heart doesn't beat right. Now, 6 hours is really a long time for a faint to cause a blackout.
Uh-huh. And so Dr. Khan is having just a little bit of a coughing fit right now, but we'll get back to your question in just a moment. In the meantime, 260-452-1185 is the number to call if you have a question or comment. You can always post on our Facebook page, Midday Matters at Midday Matters, or email us, middaymatters@nipr.fm.
Sorry about that. You know, if somebody is blacking out and we don't know why they're blacking out, certain investigations are done. Obviously, EEG is done, but I mentioned that not every time an EEG will come back positive. Then a cardiac workup to make sure it's not a cardiac etiology. Sometimes blackouts can be due to metabolic causes, for example, low sugar. So in your case, I would recommend that maybe a more extensive investigation is needed, maybe an ablatory EEG or a video EEG, and more testing should be considered.
Okay, and we have another call on the line. We have Chad on line two. Chad, welcome to Health 360.
Afternoon, ladies.
Good afternoon.
So my question is, I've never actually had a seizure myself, right? Mm-hmm. But when I was 10 years old, my grandfather had one, and I just remember the screaming. It was a horrible, he had been in an accident, so there's a whole bunch of previous stuff. But what are people like that, what are they feeling? I mean, what's the emotion, not emotion, but what does it feel like?
Some people won't feel anything because if they go into a seizure and it starts everywhere at the same time, they will probably not have awareness and they may not feel anything at all. The other thing that can happens is that people get amnesia for what happened. So they don't remember what happened at the point that they were going through it. They may have feelings and they may realize something is going on. But once they're into it and afterwards, they cannot recall what happened. They may just remember, you know, they were sitting and talking and they don't remember anything else. But a term I'm going to introduce is called aura. And aura is just the beginning of a seizure or what happens before a seizure becomes generalized. So part of your brain starts having abnormal electrical discharge. And so at that time, you're fully aware of what's going on. And then as it spreads, then you have the tonic phase and the clonic phase. For some people, if think of this, okay, if it starts in your fear area or your amygdala, you're going to be extremely fearful. So they may have emotional experiences that can be quite scary before the seizure activity spreads to the rest of the brain. What else can they feel? Well, people feel so helpless, they can't help themselves. They know they're going into it, so they're really scared because now they have no way of protecting it. They know it's coming, but they don't have enough time to control themselves. As far as people saying, well, I have head pain, usually that does not happen.
We have one more question that I'd like to get to, just about 7 minutes left in today's program. We had a listener write in that says, as a child, I had seizures and into my teen years as well. Now I'm in my 40s, and although I have not had any seizures for many years, I'm still prone to them with a particular trigger, which is blood, like in a gory movie or a scary movie. This has always been a trigger for me. Someone discussing surgery can see that it kind of takes them back, even if it's something like a bloody surgery. I have just learned to remove myself from those situations whenever possible, but can you help me to understand why something as random as this would be a trigger?
Sure. So again, this goes back to the point that everything that looks like a seizure is not a seizure. Mm. So sometimes when people have syncope or a faint, they can go into a convulsive syncope. It looks like a seizure, but it isn't. And I think the caller currently is experiencing vasovagal syncope, or when she has a trigger like blood or pain or something gory, then her blood pressure and heart rate is affected and then she passes out. So it looks like a seizure, but it isn't epileptic seizures. The other point about her having seizures in childhood but having outgrown it, that's extremely common. There are multiple types of childhood seizures. The outcome is excellent. They have multiple seizures in childhood, but as they grow older, particularly as they go into puberty, they stop having seizures. So pediatric neurologists are very used to this, and we will counsel parents and we'll give them statistics. You have almost 100% chance that you'll outgrow seizures, or you have a 70% chance of outgrowing seizures. Unfortunately, the statistics are not so rosy for adults. And again, think about it. If you have a brain tumor, you have a stroke, you have damage to the brain, and chances are you'll keep having seizures. Now, that doesn't mean that we cannot cure you.
Now, once we're on the medications, are these, we'll deal with adults now, how long do they stay on? Is there a chance after 5 years of getting off the medication? And what other modes of therapy are available for our diagnosed patients?
If a person has definite epilepsy, we want to keep them on treatment for a while. Now, for some people, it may be lifelong. And one way of determining this is do an EEG. If the EEG is still abnormal, then don't go off medications. You're still going to keep having seizures. But let's say your EEG is now completely normal. You're having a seizure for 3, 4, 5 years, and physicians determine this. Then one can take a chance and try and come off medications. You always want to discuss with your physician. You don't want to do it on your own. The other way is, let's say you're on medications and medications don't control you. We can cure epilepsy by doing surgery. So in epilepsy, the way we like to think about this is if you have failed 2 medications, chances are you're medically refractory. And at that point, I should be thinking whether you can be a surgical candidate. So if you have a seizure focus in your brain in an area that we can safely remove, without giving you terrible handicaps. And what do I mean by that? If I'm going to remove a seizure focus but make you hemiplegic, half your body doesn't work, or remove your seizure focus but now you can't speak anymore, obviously I can't do that. But there are parts of the brain where you can have surgery safely and be cured of epilepsy. That's an option. If curative surgery is not an option, then there are other forms of surgery. An example is vagal nerve stimulator. This is a device that's implanted by neurosurgeons, and they place the electrodes in the neck. And think of it as a pacemaker to the brain. There's a small pacemaker which is placed in your chest, and we program that to give you small electrical stimulation, and that may be a treatment option. A diet called ketogenic diet has been found helpful. So my motto as an epileptologist is never give up. There are all kinds of drugs available. There are other treatment options available, and there is something that can help you.
And what is the long-term outlook for the patient with diagnosed epilepsy? They do seem, even though most of them live long, normal, with normal lifespans, there does seem to be an increased morbidity. And there is an entity called sudden unexpected death in epilepsy. What is that?
So SUDEP, or sudden unexpected death in epilepsy, is a condition in which a person is found dead and they have a diagnosis of epilepsy. Now, this is not because you drowned or not because you choked on vomit. There was no obvious reason for you to die and you're found dead, typically in the morning. The reasons for SUDEP are not completely understood. It is hypothesized that it's probably autonomic dysfunction and possibly cardiac arrhythmia or abnormality of the brainstem controlling your breathing and your heart rate. I want to take a minute to emphasize how important it is to take your medications, because the incidence of SUDEP is highest in people who have uncontrolled epilepsy and particularly in people who don't take their medications. And overall, the risk is not, I won't minimize it, but it's about 1 in 1,000. But the risk in people who are poorly controlled, it's 1 in 150. So make sure you follow your physician's instructions, and if they recommend treatment options, explore it and think about other options which are non-medication, like vagal nerve stimulator or surgery to the brain, if necessary, to try and get that seizure under better control.
Dr. Khan, we're just about out of time, but thank you so much for being a part of Health 360 today.
Thank you. It has been my pleasure.
Support for this program on WBOI is provided by PHP, offering a variety of health benefits and services for individuals, families, and businesses in Northern Indiana, including medical, dental, high deductible, administrative services, and more at PHPNI.com. This is Northeast Indiana Public Radio, broadcasting from the Madge Rothschild Studios at 89.1 in HD Channel 1. We're streaming online at NIPR.FM. This is WBOI Fort Wayne and WBKE North Manchester, a service of Manchester University. Thanks very much for listening this afternoon. This edition of Midday Matters will be podcasted at our website, NIPR.FM, by the end of the day. If we didn't get to your call, we apologize again. You can head over to NIPR.FM, listen to the podcast, and see if we can answer any of your questions that way. And the conversation keeps going at our Facebook page, Midday Matters. We're coming up on 1 o'clock, and Fresh Air is up next.